The South is cleaning up from yet another round of devastating tornadoes. The storms started first in Arkansas, then brought baseball-sized hail, heavy wind, and lightning to parts of Tennessee and Mississippi. But it was Alabama that saw the worst of it. At least 2 people died, with 100 more injured. As NPR's Russell Lewis reports, the overnight storms hit communities still struggling to recover from a series of devastating tornadoes last year.
Just past daybreak in Center Point, Alabama, Marcel Horn stood on the city's main road, blocked by deputies because of downed power lines. Horn had tears streaming down his face as he looked up.
I've just been saying 100 prayers.
Some cell towers blew over and the phone lines were jammed. Horn hadn't heard from his fiance and was worried about his son and her daughter. It was the second time in less than a year a tornado had targeted his family. During the devastating April twisters, which killed almost 250 people, his parents' home, the next town over, was destroyed.
I don't know what it is. It can't be God, because it's devastation, man. I don't know where we're going to begin at again, man. Like, my family, they haven't even recovered yet. Now I need some help. They need the help. Now I need some help. I don't know where to begin, sir. I just don't know where to begin.
Center Point is a predominantly black suburb of Birmingham with about 17,000 residents. All morning long, police radios cackled, ambulances raced across town, and helicopters flew overhead taking in the damage. The devastation spared few people, it seemed. Entire businesses were flattened. The veterinary clinic was blown out. But amazingly, every cat and dog in the kennels survived. Street signs were wrapped all the way around telephone poles and looked like twist ties from a loaf of bread. Elsewhere, massive pine trees blew over, crushing houses, cars, and anything else in their way. Michelle Simmons stood on her doorstep, reliving the terror of the tornado.
And it got louder and louder and louder. And then all the glass and everything started flying. Stuff off the wall started flying. And then that tree fell on top of the house. And it blew my husband off the bed on the side over the kids. A 300-pound man, it picked up off the bed and threw him over against the wall.
Firefighters continued to hear stories like that one as they went house to house searching for survivors. One block over on 23rd Terrace, John Lischte used a chainsaw to cut up what was left of his parents' stately magnolia tree. He was so busy he didn't want to switch off his saw as we talked. He says he's trying to look at the bright side.
Well, my mom and dad are fine. They're safe. That's what's important. I mean, our friends across the street are okay. You know, they had trees fall down on their house, but, I mean, you know, you get along, move on. We'll manage.
Alabama's Governor Robert Bentley declared a state of emergency. And ironically, this was also the day he was to receive a report on the devastating April tornado outbreak with suggestions on how the state better prepare and respond to future disasters, something Alabama is getting good at doing. Russell Lewis, NPR News, Birmingham.
All Things Considered continues in a moment.
The first bids are due today for one of the most storied franchises in pro sports. The Los Angeles Dodgers are up for auction after Major League Baseball forced the deeply unpopular owner Frank McCourt to give up control of the team. The Dodgers lost their luster and then some under McCourt's ownership, but NPR's Tom Goldman reports that the new sale price could still set a record.
So, you want to own the Dodgers? First, get $1 billion or more. Estimates for the winning bid range from $1.2 to $2 billion. Obviously, only 1%ers need apply, and they have in droves. We don't know the whole list. There's a lot of secrecy and non-disclosure requirements surrounding the process, but we know some of those involved. Billionaire hedge fund manager Steve Cohen, Tom Barak, real estate titan, and then the names we recognize, former Dodgers stars Oral Hershiser and Steve Garvey, former Dodgers manager Joe Torre, and then some cross cross-league pollination. L.A. Lakers legend Magic Johnson reportedly is in, as is NBA Bad Boy owner Mark Cuban. He played coy with NBC's Jay Leno a couple of days ago.
Would you like to buy the Dodgers if it was possible?
It could be fun. Could you imagine? L.A. would never be the same.
Neither would the Dodgers. And if you ask most Angelenos who care about the team, that would be a good thing. The McCourt years were marred by the lavish lifestyles of Frank and now ex-wife Jamie, funded in part by team money, their bitter public divorce, and a less than enjoyable and sometimes dangerous ballpark experience at Dodger Stadium that ultimately led to vast swaths of empty seats. So, with the franchise in decline, why the ownership interest and huge projected sale price?
It's a reflection of the opportunity value if done properly.
Meaning, according to sports business expert Mark Gannis, there's gold in Chavez Ravine, the Dodgers' home in the hills overlooking downtown L.A. Gannis, president of Sports Corp Limited, a consulting firm that focuses on team acquisitions, says three little letters, RSN, potentially make the Dodgers, already a fabled franchise, an astronomically valuable one as well. RSN, Regional Sports Network, like the ones included in a new long-term TV deal between Time Warner Cable and the L.A. Lakers that Gannis says potentially could be worth $3 billion.
That was so extreme that it makes many people feel that there's something unique about the Los Angeles market that should allow for a monstrous rights fee or regional sports network equity deal.
Monstrous rights fees and RSN equity deals are of little concern to the 99%ers who won't be bidding on the Dodgers, but many of them are hopeful that new ownership will make it easier to cheer on the team. At last night's Lakers game, Dodgers fan Arturo Hernandez got specific.
Hopefully they can lower the price on the beer, that's for damn sure.
But before there's cheap beer, there's a thorough vetting process of up to 10 bidders by Major League Baseball. Those who make it through that will take part in an auction. Frank McCourt reportedly will reveal the winning bid by early April and then use an estimated $1 billion of it to pay off his debts. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. When the president delivers his annual State of the Union address tomorrow, the economy will, of course, be a top issue. And housing is still at the heart of the country's economic woes. The Federal Reserve said this month that the crash in home prices has cost $7 trillion in household wealth. And that means people and businesses are spending a lot less. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
The state of the housing market is definitely not strong. On the campaign trail in Florida today, Republican Mitt Romney offered this assessment.
It doesn't have to be like this. It can get better. It will get better.
Romney and his fellow Republican candidates haven't offered many specifics about how housing will get better or when.
I can't predict when it's going to get better other than if I'm fortunate enough to become president, I will care very deeply about getting it better in a big hurry.
But it is at least possible now to take a glass half-full view of things. Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics. He's been tracking the housing market closely and advising policymakers in Washington.
Well, the six-year-long housing crash is coming to an end. It's not quite over. I think we've got a bit more to go with respect to house price declines. But for the first time since late 2005-06, I think the trend lines look actually quite good for housing.
Zandi says the pace of home sales is picking up. That, though, does not mean that lots of average Americans are jumping back in, getting loans, buying houses, and brimming with confidence. The fact is that many of those sales are actually investors using cash to buy foreclosed properties. That might not sound so good, but Zandi says he likes to see that.
Yeah, investors are probably about a third of the existing home market right now, a very important part of the market. Which is very encouraging. They sense value. The prices have now fallen enough that investors can come in, scarf up these properties, rent, cover their costs, and hold on. These aren't flippers. They're looking out 3-5 years.
Still, it's likely to be 2 or 3 years before housing starts to look really healthy again. For now, we're still at the bottom of the cliff. And from that perspective, things are so bad that housing economists Patrick Newport and Eric Johnson felt the need to title a recent report on housing in Latin.
Oh, I like Eric pronounce it because he has 5 years of Latin and I don't.
6 years, actually. Well, for the housing sector, 2011 turned out to be an annus horribilis, just a horrible year for housing.
If you look at home construction, the numbers are striking. Newport and Johnson are with IHS Global Insight. They say that the past 3 years have been the worst since before record-keeping began.
The lowest level since World War II.
And that's not adjusted for population. So we are actually building fewer houses in the U.S. than we have in more than 60 years. And that translates into a lot of unemployed or underemployed construction workers. Patrick Newport.
It's not only that the numbers are low nationally, but they're bad in just about everywhere, in every state of the country.
One problem is that millions of foreclosed homes keep glutting the market. Meanwhile, foreclosure prevention efforts have been very tangled up. Neil Borofsky served as the Special Inspector General overseeing the so-called TARP program in Washington.
I think, unfortunately, we've seen remarkably little progress since where we were a year ago.
President Obama's foreclosure prevention plan is called HAMP, and it was supposed to help 3 to 4 million homeowners. But so far it's reached less than a million, and lately it seems to be slowing down.
That's a correct characterization. If anything, the HAMP program has gone from an anemic program to one that is even more mediocre than it was just a few months ago.
Borofsky blames the banks, and he also blames the Obama administration for not pushing the banks harder. Still, some economists hold out hope for some new efforts to help housing. One we might see in the next year aims to take foreclosed homes and convert them into rental properties on a large scale. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Every year, the American Library Association awards the Caldecott Medal to the most distinguished picture book for children that's published in the U.S. And today the winner was announced, and he is a past medalist, Chris Roschka. His book is called A Ball for Daisy. Roschka also won in 2006 for The Hello Goodbye Window, and he was a Caldecott honoree or finalist in 1994 for the book Yo, Yes? Chris Roschka, did I get the inflection right on that?
That's perfect. That's exactly right.
Chris Roschka joins us from New York, and congratulations on the medal for A Ball
Thank
for
Daisy.
Thank
you so much.
I would ask you for a reading of the book, but alas, it has no words.
It's my first wordless picture book. Certainly a challenge, and it went through many, many variations.
With the proper spoiler alert, why don't you roughly tell us the story of A Ball for Daisy?
Well, it's about a little dog named Daisy who has a big red ball that she loves very much. And her owner, a little girl, takes her to the park and they play until this beloved ball is in a wrestling match with another dog, is popped and comes to an end of its existence. And Daisy is distraught. And where we go from there was what I set myself as a task.
It's the old dog has ball, dog loses ball.
Exactly.
A dog laments and eventually, if you're not listening, all 3 to 7-year-olds gets another ball is what happens in the story.
That's right.
And this story, how did you decide to do this?
Well, it does come from a real experience, but in this case it was not a dog named Daisy. It was my son named Ingo, whose beloved ball was actually destroyed by a dog. When he was 4, this happened, and it was such a devastation for him. It was kind of almost the first time he experienced something he loved ending and that he couldn't get that back.
Now, in years past, you have drawn, or I guess painted is mm-hmm. more appropriate, children's books about some unusual subjects. Mm-hmm. Charlie Parker Played Bebop is one of your books. Mysterious yes. Thelonious is another
yes.
one.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, Arlene Sardine, the story of a fish who dreamt of becoming someone's breakfast.
Yes.
How do you settle on these subjects?
Well, anything that creates a strong emotion in me, whether it's music, loss of something, loneliness or friendship, if that emotion is heightened in some way and painted to fit in between the covers of 32 pages, that can become a picture book.
So here's the question that I have for you, having looked at a ball for Daisy, in which we see many pictures of Daisy the little dog. My question is, how do you as an artist manage to draw a character so many times, doing many different things, seen from different angles, so that she's always perfectly recognizable? Is there a wastebasket full of bad drawings of Daisy that don't make it in?
You can't imagine how big that wastebasket is. It is, in fact, sometimes I worry about the amount of paper I waste. And
you can do a story about a tree that wants to be somebody's book.
Very sadly, I'm afraid I can. But well, for me, finding that is the real challenge, and especially because I like to be fairly gestural, that is not repaired, kind of immediate. So it either works or it doesn't work, and that's the fine line to find, literally.
Chris Roschke, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
It's Chris Roschke, winner of the Caldecott Medal. His book is called A Ball for Daisy.
Now to technology unlocking the ivory tower. NPR's Steve Henn takes us to Stanford, where professors are making classes available online to thousands.
Last semester, Sebastian Thrun, who helped build a self-driving car for Google, got together with a small group of other Stanford computer science professors, and pretty impulsively, they decided to open their Stanford classes to the world and allow anyone anywhere to attend online for free, take quizzes, ask questions, even get grades. They made this announcement with almost no fanfare, sending out a single email to a professional group.
Within hours, we had 5,000 students sign up. That was on a Saturday morning. And Sunday night, we had 10,000 students.
Eventually, more than 160,000 students signed up for Thrun's class with Peter Norvig on artificial intelligence, or AI.
We reached many more students, Peter and I, in this one class than all other AI professors combined reached in the last year.
People from 190 countries signed up. Students from the Australian outback, Shanghai, Africa, the Ukraine, and all over the United States studied together online. After it was over, videos offering thanks flooded in.
My name is Jack
Hello.
Wise.
My name is Melody Bliss.
Hi, my name is Bilfell Gunshala.
Hi, my name is Janine Cohen.
I'm from Tallahassee, Florida.
First of Lagos, Nigeria.
All of these students and tens of thousands of others completed the class.
I teach math, science, robotics, and computer technology at a
I am a disabled woman going through dialysis three times a week.
I'm 16 years old.
They took the same class Stanford students took, and they got grades. But they didn't pay a cent, and they didn't get credit. Jim Plummer's the dean of engineering.
I think it will actually be a long time, maybe never, when actual Stanford degrees would be given for fully online work by anyone who wished to register for the courses.
Stanford does give degrees for online work, but only to students who get through the admissions process and pay, often $40,000 or $50,000 for a master's degree. But technology could push prices down.
On the long term, I think the potential for this to revolutionize education is just tremendous.
Daphne Kohler is a computer science professor at Stanford and a MacArthur Genius Fellow. She's been working to make online education more engaging and interactive for years.
There are millions of people around the world that have access only to the poorest quality of education or sometimes nothing at all.
Kohler says technology could change that. She says it makes it possible in many subjects to teach classes with 100,000 students as easily and almost as cheaply as a class that has just 100 students. And if you look around the world, the demand for education in places like South Africa is enormous.
In the University of Johannesburg, a few weeks ago, they had a very small number of places that was still open. And so there were thousands of people parked outside the gate, sitting there for the gates to open so they could be first in line to register for that limited number of slots. And when the gates opened, there was a stampede.
20 people were injured and one woman was killed. Kohler hopes in the future, technology will make these kinds of tragedies preventable. In this semester, Stanford will put 17 interactive courses online for free. Over the last 6 months, Sebastian Thrun has spent roughly $200,000 of his own money and lined up venture capital to create a new online institution of higher learning, independent of Stanford.
The name is Udacity. We are committed to free online education for everybody.
Udacity is announcing two new classes today. One will teach students to build their own search engine. Another, how to program a self-driving car. Eventually, the founders hope to offer a full slate of classes in computer science, all for free. Throne believes Stanford's mission is really to attract the top 1% of students from all over the world and bring them to campus. He says Udacity's mission is different. Free, quality education for all, anywhere. A sweeping, disruptive technology. Here's Daphne Koller.
What I think is clear is that this change is coming, and it's coming whether we like it or not. And so I think the right strategy is to embrace that change.
Over the years, Stanford has launched dozens of disruptive technologies into the world. But now administrators and professors here seem to agree it could be about to disrupt itself. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to protect photos, music, and other computer files from loss. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.